from the Dark Mood Woods, a Twin Peaks podcast.
Hello, this is Ethan. Joining me is
Nick Newman.
And hey. Special guest.
Hey, I'm Zach Lewis. I write about film sometimes.
Not enough, though. Not enough. Before we get started talking about Hour 7 of Twin Peaks, the hour simply entitled There's a Body, All Right, Zach, maybe you can just talk a little bit about your feelings on David Lynch in general, and also thoughts on the return so far.
Yeah, sure thing. I came to David Lynch, as any like cinephile would do, right? You know, like a grandfather of all this kind of stuff. Started with Eraserhead, you know, it's just kind of this fun thing to watch during your college years, I suppose. Hanging around like, people who watch the same kind of things as you. You want to watch something really interesting around midnight or so. I watched the entire Twin Peaks series about the same time during college. Perhaps that dates me. I watched it on Netflix whenever it came back then. Slowly started getting into them. And you start noticing this kind of like increase of the quality of his work throughout the years that go by, and that despite the fact that he's getting older and seems to have more and more kind of like weird feelings toward young people as he goes along, kind of becomes more interesting with that. You know, I definitely enjoy Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire in his later career the most. And of course, you know, I love Twin Peaks, The Return. I mean, maybe we can get into this a little later, but I was just discussing before coming onto this podcast with a friend of mine, goes by the name of Chris, that David Lynch is kind of fixing himself in the culture in the same way that Alfred Hitchcock maybe is, as like the kind of thing where it's like if you don't like him, it's kind of like a bad heresy. Maybe there's like good heresies and bad heresies to have as film fans, but definitely like getting away from Hitchcock or Lynch both seems this kind of very weird thing to do. And, they still deal with the same kind of the themes of, like, this weird psychosexual stuff going on with what they're doing. They have the same kind of, like, creepy vibe and whatnot. But I really just haven't come across anybody that really does not like The Return for any kind of reason that I can really, like, nod my head to, I suppose. And I'm glad about that. I'm glad that, like, you know, somebody who's, like, doing this weird, truly, very American avant-garde work is being seen by a lot of people. I suppose that's the smartest general thing I can say about the series so far. But I've just really been enjoying that, like, David Lynch is back in the conversation and doing some of his best work, and people are really appreciating that.
We should note also part of our a reason for inviting Zach on beyond him just being a great guy is his... apparently he's said in real life he plans to go as Alpha Coop for Halloween.
is that the actual name of that coop on this show? Is that
that's our handle.
Okay, cool. I need a little thing to tie my hair back, but then absolutely yes, that's me. I look like him. I act like him. I do all the things that he does.
You've got the same voice too, really.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, if we just want to dive into this very strange hour of television, then the first thing I'll say, at least we just get the ball rolling, is what I thought was interesting about this episode was how of all the episodes, or as we say every week, hours so far, it felt like the one that balanced the most kind of what I'd say exposition plot as well as mood. Like, I mean, I think maybe just an interesting thing to say is that Dougie, who's essentially been the fulcrum of the show, really, at least last few hours, doesn't appear until, I believe, 33 minutes into the episode. So it shows that the show's sort of throwing us out of whack a little, and we're sort of, I mean, just judging infractions, we're officially entering what you could say is the second act. So we're starting kind of to see the pieces set up. I mean, one of the first scenes in this episode is, of course, a long extended sequence between the Hawk and Frank Truman, which, again, is essentially exposition. But it's like the rest of the show, it's done in such a relaxed manner that you kind of forget about it. I think in particular, which is helped by Robert Forster's very just relaxed line readings. I mean, what were your sort of impressions of this episode so far, maybe relating in terms of balancing plot and mood?
Well, I'll jump in now and I'll say that watching it kind of early on, actually, the words that came to mind because of this episode were serving two masters, which I think is a bit of a high wire, tricky place to walk because that implies a certain preference or expertise on Lynch's part in one terrain over the other, and I don't really want to go there. I guess what I mean by that is, again, balance. It was strange watching this episode progress in a fairly linear fashion. You have this whole section of the episode really devoted to Gordon Cole, Albert, and Diane, who we're finally getting something from other than just her turning around and sort of glancing ominously. And as it turns out, as we learn, Diane is a little salty, which is... which is a revelation that I liked. I thought it was funny how the character who has been entirely silent, entirely unseen, by some fan theories not even real, has a bit of a sailor's mouth on her and is, in Gordon Cole's words, a tough cookie. And watching this dynamic come into play, I thought was really fascinating in what it revealed about Gordon Cole and how he deals with his FBI agents. I don't think it was really much of a secret before that he's a very manipulative guy who's very good at getting people to do what he wants, partly by not telling them anything.
Maybe like Lynch in real life, huh?
But watching this, I was really fascinated with how the sense of duration in this and the sense of space and sound really brought that out. When they go to what is ostensibly Diane's apartment, assumedly her apartment, there's this part where she's walking away and he says, "She's always been a tough cookie." And the camera holds on Gordon and Albert for a few seconds. And then it cuts to her coming back in and he starts talking again when he's certain that she can hear him. And even the way he's sort of buttering her up was interesting in how he takes a sip of coffee and he says the famous line that we have not heard in this series until now, which is "damn good coffee." But even the way he says it, there seems to be something kind of fake and manipulative about it. And then later when they're on the airplane, the way that normally, you know, it's common for him to talk loudly because of his hearing deficiency. But even the way he's talking here, trying to communicate things to Diane, who is facing away from him, I thought was really fascinating. And it was another thing of how we've kind of seen maybe a slightly darker side to this character recently, because we've learned that he has a bit of a thing for sleeping with the young female agents. And you might have noticed at one point in that scene when they're on the airplane, he's kind of eyeing Krista Bell's Tamara Preston a little bit. He's sort of looking her up and down as they're sitting down. This is a bit of a long tangent into saying that the linear quality of the episode I thought worked well, because there is so much going on now, there are so many balls in the air, that to have a moment to breathe and kind of laser focus on a particular strand I thought was necessary and needed. And then we also have somebody sweeping the floor for about 2 minutes, and it seems uncertain if the episode might actually end there. And then when it seems like it's going into a more normal terrain, then the episode ends on a really strange note of everybody in a diner. Somebody comes in and asks for a character who we don't know, who we don't see. And then that's the end of the episode. There was kind of a repartee between, well, you know, I don't want to quote Bret Easton Ellis here when I say mood and atmosphere, but there was a bit of a repartee between mood and atmosphere and narrative.
Lick your lips while you say that.
American cinema of the 70s. Anyway.
Yeah. A division between what, like plot and what? Because I feel that this is a very like common conversation that comes up with Twin Peaks. It's like there's plot and there's something else. What do you guys think is that something else here? I'm curious about that.
For me, it's taking a bit of time to just sort of enjoy the world around you, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just in time. I mean, I bring up the scene of the guy sweeping the floor, which plays a bit to Lynch's more slow cinema side, which is something that I think goes unremarked upon often. I would also say the sequences with Harry Goaz's Andy involved in some kind of strange meetup with a shady-looking guy. Even a lot of that, it's him standing outside in relative silence. It even brings back an Angelo Badalamenti theme that we haven't heard, I think, in this entire series, kind of right. As the camera is floating above the trees and then it goes down and he's standing there and it's this very kind of earthy, gray sort of atmosphere. You know, those are the things that don't necessarily move us forward. It's not entirely important that we see this, or at least for the time being, it doesn't feel entirely important that we see this, but it is taking a second to breathe and let something a bit quieter flourish, I guess I would say.
Right. And that's the same kind of things I talk to people whenever I talk about Twin Peaks as well. And it plays in well with Lynch's sense of like, you know, doubles and everything. It's like we have both the plot and maybe the mood, or perhaps like the slow going but funny kind of atmosphere of Twin Peaks itself. But maybe you also want some world building, maybe you also want some answers. Maybe there's a split between Lynch and Frost, right? I believe like a lot of us want to talk about what Lynch's part in the series is as opposed to Frost. It was brought to my attention nowadays because I haven't read the book that Frost actually has this huge sense of world building that's outside the show entirely that I haven't quite gotten to yet, that involves like Lewis and Clark and Richard Nixon, who are like both like very aware of the Black Lodge to some extent. Like Lewis being killed by somebody perhaps in the Black Lodge at the age of 35, Richard Nixon knowing a bit about this, you know, because it has to get closer and closer to the FBI. And so as to which like parts of this are very Lynchian and which parts of this are very Frostian are also up in the air. This particular episode, though, I noticed particularly that everything's still kind of easygoing, even within the Gordon Cole scenes, until we get to the attempted assassination of Dougie, perhaps Cooper, with that little scene where he kind of like breaks through. That felt very Lynchian to me, late Lynchian, right? As I was talking about earlier, all of a sudden it becomes very digital, it becomes very intense. The mood kind of like drops. We have this great musical build up to it with that kind of hum that's alluded to later in the episode, which scares us a bit, but comes in full force a little bit before it with this scene. The scene where it's like squeeze his arm off, and then the couple shots we get after with that very intense digital. I feel like if we're going to split things between the two, I think it's like the ability for Twin Peaks to be so funny and to be so terrifying at the exact same time. Lynch, for me, is somebody who's really terrified me, getting to the renowned The Face around 3 a.m. the first time I watched Inland Empire, you know, and the Bob scenes in the first two seasons very much scared me. But this season's been making me laugh so much. I feel, if anything, the division between, if we're going to talk about some sort of like double atmosphere of Twin Peaks, is definitely that, and its balancing act. This episode had both. Right, it has a few Dougie scenes, has a few weird stuff, but I think we're getting back into a darker kind of element. And if we are starting the second act, maybe we're getting back closer to the mood between episodes 1 and 2, whenever it starts off everything again.
I think what's curious too about this episode, what's really at the forefront, and this is something that's carried through the return so far, is the specter of death, really. I mean, one of the first scenes in the episode is a Skype conversation between Sheriff Truman and Doc Hayward, the late Warren Frost, who's, you can say, like, visibly, in his last year of life. Like, it's kind of apparent watching him on screen. And something to note, too, I think it's interesting that the show has a Skype scene between two very old men. As to my knowledge, that's basically how Lynch and Frost wrote this season, was over Skype. So I feel like that scene might be a commentary on that. But we also have... we get more of Ashley Judd's character glimpsed at in the second scene, the very first episode. So it's been a big gap. And we find out more about her, that she's taking care of a dying husband. So really, I think there's humor, there's terror, but there's also, of course, melancholy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, another thing too, I guess maybe talking about another sequence in the show that leaves a lot hanging in the air as to why we're seeing it, what we're seeing, is a sequence where this is, I think, really sort of a classic peak sequence where Ashley Judd's Beverly and Ben Horn, who we haven't seen in a while, are investigating some sort of sound that is emanating from the Great Northern Hotel. And, you know, I don't know how good a sound system you guys watched the episode on, but I really love the scene for, among other things, the actual sound that was coming out of the walls, which is some sort of slight musical hum. And the sequence goes on for a few minutes, and it's really just them going back and forth in the room in this sort of golden burnished environment. And where it leads to, I couldn't really say, but there's something in it about embracing the mystery and sort of taking a second to enjoy the environment. And it ends with, again, like a very mysterious, almost Inland Empire-like shot of the camera panning around the room and then going sort of into a wall, but then fading out at that moment. And it's funny, too. It's a classic peak sequence that immediately follows something that we've never seen from the show before, which is some sort of newscast with almost like a found footage approach after Dougie / Dale Cooper stops Ike the Spike's assassination. And it was completely surprising. I don't know how you guys reacted to it when it showed up, but I kind of just immediately went, whoa, this is entirely different. This is like nothing they've done before. And he's still having a lot of fun with it. And he's also, again, creating this porous reality, this porous border between reality and fiction, or I should say, reality and the Black Lodge or whatever it is, because you have these weird irises on particular objects. And I don't know. I'm wondering what you guys thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, it too, there's some great humor in those scenes too, with one of the witnesses saying that Dougie was like a cobra, in particular, being one of my favorite lines of the episode. And I actually wanted to mention, though, about the assassination scene earlier, that you were bringing up sound. When I watched the episode a second time, maybe you noticed this, how loud on the mix the sound, you could call maybe the karate chop from Dougie is. Like, how comically loud it is. It almost sounds like it's from a martial arts movie or something.
Also, the sound that Ike the Spike makes is sort of like pigs fucking.
that scene, it's very weird because, like, it starts off, the sound design, it has, again, like, nearly the same kind of hum that you hear later on. Classic, like, Lynch stable to have that kind of sound design, right? Since he's constantly thinking about the way the visuals look, the way that these kind of, like, weird characters would look, you know, the tree looking just like one of his paintings or sculptures or something like that. The electric sounds coming out as well. Was there electric sounds on the mix whenever the arm is there talking to Dougie? Do you recall that?
I think it's the ethereal whooshing.
Okay, right. I think, like, it was very weird leading it off and having Naomi Watts and having that very, like, that kind of scene like that. It doesn't quite come out of nowhere in the same way that in Mulholland Drive, whenever they're going back behind the restaurant, the creature there doesn't come out of nowhere. I'm forgetting, like, the proper nouns of all these Lynchian things. But it kind of gives you this kind of setup, will it or won't it kind of thing that I think is very Lynchian, has me calling again, just as like this kind of personal thing in my head, whether or not how much Lynch or Frost were involved in each individual scene. But that just, the assassination scene in particular just seems very Lynchian to me.
There's also, I mean, if we want to talk about returning characters, there's the supernatural entity seen in hour two, the what looked like the, we could call maybe the charcoal man, introduced in such a nonchalant way, essentially first seen just out of focus and eventually walking into focus. And I don't know about what your reaction was seeing that scene for the first time, but I almost, when I first noticed it, I just thought, no, like that's not, because it's very noticeable there's a dark object in the background walking. It was like, no, that's not going to be something. Like, no. And then it was.
Yeah, no. Again, it's a thing where I think watching this show, you're accustomed to the ethereal whooshing. You're accustomed to the tones and the hums. So when there's this dark silhouetted figure appearing in the background, I thought it was not a coincidence, because I don't know if anything in this is really a coincidence, but I was unsure, because even the sequence itself, the conversation that's playing out, isn't necessarily an edge of your seat sort of thing. It doesn't totally feel like a grand revelation. It's sort of playing with something we've known before, that there is this body and there are fingerprints relating to Major Briggs. So it really kind of snuck up on me in that way. And then you have the next part of the sequence, which is inside, more directly inside the morgue with the body. And the way the camera is fixed, you're thinking to yourself, okay, the figure is walking towards them, ostensibly. But if he's walking towards them, how exactly is he going to appear? Is there going to be some sort of cut? Or is he just going to pop in the frame? And the camera does this very elegant move to the side to allow him to appear. And then he disappears just as soon. I really loved that sequence and the staging of it. I thought that was really beautiful.
Yeah, it really kind of goes out of its way, right? Because, I mean, that's another thing, is it does that slow build. Again, Lynch is not one for jump scares, because when he does it, like, it's going to be once, right? It's going to be once or twice per whatever he does, and it's going to be very effective. So, the slow build of him coming toward it, and the I guess the acknowledgement, right? Because she does turn toward him for a second. So it's not just this kind of like spectral figure that's meant to be some sort of like metaphor that we're going to figure out. It's actually there, right? Like it can possibly terrorize them if it so wants. And yeah, this thing is like a beautiful moment that the camera chose to pan over just to acknowledge to the audience, to ourselves, right? Because it does no benefit to the characters in the show that the camera pans over, that we see him just kind of like steadily walk by, which means his intention wasn't toward them. It's just toward us, right? It's to play with us, the audience. And I think that's one of those rare moments where the audience can call attention to a kind of formal choice being made in the show, right? It's not invisible editing. We're acknowledged that we're with the camera and that we're following through. And I think Lynch has been in the game long enough to know what the power of that is.
I mean, you brought up Major Briggs, Nick. I mean, we get an interesting revelation this week that apparently that the body, we have found the body of his, but it would have been a recently deceased late 40s man instead of a 25 years gone 70-year-old man. So, and the head, it's lacking a head, so I don't know, because we have actually seen Major Briggs' head so far this season floating through the Black Lodge, so I'm kind of curious if they're implicating that bodies are separated in different dimensions. I don't know.
No, yeah, I don't know. I mean, but it is, again, I do like how the show's mystery aspect can incorporate some very practical questions. For instance, how would this be the body of this man who died 25 years ago? Or how would the body still be preserved like so? And it is one of those things where allowing you to kind of be a, in a sense, be a detective with the show as it's progressing. And it's also the kind of thing that I don't necessarily expect the show to fuss over too much, I guess. I think if this current run of episodes has shown us anything, it's that the show is either really going to take its time or it's going to let those things kind of recede, which is typical of Lynch, but wasn't necessarily typical of Twin Peaks, the original series, with the exception of, say, you know, Who Killed Laura Palmer, which they had intended to let run forever, the show moved at a noticeably quicker clip in just about every regard. But here, are we going to find out much more about, you know, what's happening with Major Briggs? I mean, perhaps. He's a very important figure in the secret history of Twin Peaks. And I don't know if any of us watching it were starting to think to ourselves, and perhaps because in the book itself, it is said that it was found at a crime scene relating to the investigation into Laura Palmer's death 25 years previously. And I think it was in the at the end of the first part when a box is recovered from the back of Matthew Lord's car, I found myself wondering, oh, is this actually the is this actually where they find the book? Because then Major Briggs's fingerprints are all over this crime scene. But again, you could just sort of really fall down a rabbit hole trying to piece those things together.
Yeah, the Major Briggs character definitely, you know, he's able to represent this kind of element of Twin Peaks that's very seductive, right? Because, you know, as much as we all love like the melodrama and everything, like one of the most seductive parts of the show is the mythology that they build around it. No easy answers until like some kind of answers in this third season. And Major Briggs is kind of this figure where it's, you know, how much does the government know about like what Twin Peaks is? Like, is there going to be some point where Gordon Cole goes, oh yeah, I guess it's that extra dimension thing that we have all this research about, right? Like, at what point is that going to happen? At what point is like this kind of like steady revelation going to happen? So I feel that Major Briggs definitely represents, if we're going to talk about like the two parts of Twin Peaks, like the kind of like plot, what steadily goes along, and the actual world, the mythology building and everything, Major Briggs is definitely the central character and what makes it so interesting, because it seems that he has the answers and he just can't divulge it at any point. So with him gone, it kind of makes this big hole where like we are forced to put it back together. And his death is one of the saddest for fans, because we can't have this figure that does know things and could possibly give us some sort of answers for it. And of course, like whenever he's dead, it has this extra hidden weird thing of his body being 20 years younger than it should be. It just kind of makes sense in that aspect. But it's sad for me as like somebody who like will nerd out about that in the same way that most people would nerd out about like Marvel Cinematic Universe or whatever, right? This is the fan stuff going on with him.
I wanted to bring up maybe one of the best scenes in the episode, or the hour, as I keep saying, which is, of course, the Diane Alpha Coop confrontation, which of course mirrors the Gordon Albert Tammy confrontation from 3 hours earlier. But this having all this kind of history to it that even that scene didn't have, maybe we're supposed to read a little bit of McLaughlin and Dern in real life, I'm not sure, but there's kind of been a debate about, because there's a line Diane says, it's like she talks about the last night I saw you, and are we to assume that the last night when she saw him is good Coop, or did Alpha Coop visit her?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, if nothing else, I was deeply in love with that sequence between the two of them. I mean, quote unquote, between the two of them, since there's such a separation. But I did get slight Inland Empire vibes with the close up of Dern and the all black background, kind of that that sort of falling into a ceaseless void quality that it has, which I think is appropriate for the sequence in question. And it was good to have Alpha Coop back for a bit too, because I am greatly enjoying his exploits involving Mr. Strawberry, which I think, are we to infer that that's the dog to whose, you know, who had the leg that was in his car? That was kind of the implication of it. And what exactly, again, I mean, I know I'm just saying this over and over, but what exactly that leads to or ties into, I can't say, but I am enjoying kind of this career criminal quality. On the one hand, there is something very kind of almost ordinary about the character and how he has this criminal empire. And as we see, he likes to lounge by the pool of his divine estate, which is a wonderful little shot. And I'm also wondering how much fun it must have been to create that photo in Photoshop of him walking on the side. Like, first, like, under what circumstances was that photo even taken?
Exactly. He's a lot better dressed, too, I'll say, in that.
Yeah, he has a bit of a Miami Vice thing going on, which I think is fitting. And I like that Lynch's vision of this guy in his lounge state is basically, you know, Crockett or Tubbs. And we also, at that same point, we kind of go back, I think, a little bit to one of my favorite parts of Fire Walk With Me, which is Lil, his Gordon Cole's mother's sister's girl, and how he is toying with his agents with regards to knowing things or leaning towards things and telling them to follow their intuition. In this case, it is Tamara Preston's 10 fingers and how there is one special finger. What is the exact term he uses for it? Do either of you remember?
Spirit mound.
Spirit mound, yes. Which appropriately, perhaps appropriately, is also the wedding ring finger. And since rings play such a part in the Twin Peaks mythology, I think that will lead to something very interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting, right? Because, what's the mythology around that so far? That he says, that, you know, it's very, very good to see you again, old friend, but that first very is backwards, and that, you know, his finger is backwards in his new fingerprints, right? He's all about relationships and the kind of perils of settling down in some sort of safe environment. So perhaps marriage will be a bigger theme. I'm enjoying the evil coop, alpha coop, Laura Dern sequences as well. His difference between his Manhattan outfit and his Brooklyn outfit. I do wonder though, something that's always like stuck with me for the entirety of Twin Peaks, these extra dimensional beings who are coming back from some sort of like grand purpose from either like some sort of like aliens or whatever the explanation is going to end up being overall and everything. They seem to be like really engaging in like some sort of like petty crime. How do you feel about that? Is that they're going around like doing like casual things, like obviously what they're doing is evil, but it's just like, what, you know, why do like tiny people matter in their lives? Why kill?
They gotta make the moolah.
Is this gonna be some sort of big capitalist critique at the end? I'd be fine with that, but like how do you feel about like the kind of, Does it make sense that like how grand the mythology is compared to the kind of like crimes that they're doing, like just running drugs from Canada to the United States or killing teenagers or something, right? Does this add up to you? Does this the scale of this work?
I suppose as far as collecting and harvesting garmanbozia, also known as pain and sorrow, regular crime is probably a good resource because there's so much that can be done with it and there's so much that can be done kind of in perpetuity. There's always a teen girl to prey on, as I think we have kind of seen with the presence of Amanda Seyfried in one of the more recent episodes. There are kind of these things where there will always be the supply, there will always be people to prey on and to take advantage of and to hurt. So as far as petty crime goes, I think that if they can collect their cream corn any way they can, you know, and also maintain something of a low profile too, you know, it's kind of funny to think that Alpha Coop is living in this mansion by the water when in fact a lot of them, as David Bowie told us in Firewalk With Me, live above a convenience store. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting how his, perhaps there's a bit of hubris on his part. There's a bit of additional extravagance that he is learning to love.
The real garmanbozia, neoliberalism.
Wow,
it's true. This is all a meta. This is a grand metaphor for the Mont Pelerin Society. It's all a grand metaphor. The convenience store above hand and everything. I'm with it, Ethan.
Thank you, Zach. That's why we're having you on. We need a yes man. Well, do we have any concluding thoughts on this episode?
I would throw a question to all of you and say that as we get into the second act of the show, how are you finding the series momentum? Because I am definitely finding that it's moving along at a nice pace and that the allotted hour for each part is progressing nicely. And it's strange to think that in just a few weeks, we'll be at the halfway mark. We would be there sooner if there were actually an episode airing on July 2nd, but in a few weeks we'll be at the halfway part, and it all seems to be happening very fast, but there's still something like, what, 12 hours left? Yeah, I don't know. I'm wondering how you guys are finding the narrative thrust.
Yeah, it feels to me every single time I finish an episode, and this might just because I watched episodes 1 through 4 twice, and it's just so much to have all that new stuff right in your face immediately, right? But it feels like so much happens during those 4 episodes. That every episode past them, 5, 6, and 7, it's felt like nothing's really happened. I mean, there's like a lot of like great Dougie scenes. I've thoroughly enjoyed them, but it's taken me to watch the episode and to talk to people and to really reflect on it to think that, like, oh, actually a lot has happened. We actually got like an answer to like season 1 and 2 that we've been waiting for forever. And like, I'm just kind of like going past that because all I remember is like an extended 20-minute sequence of like some sort of Dougie thing, which I would love, but like I wouldn't quite, you know, chalk up to some sort of huge narrative development or even like some sort of Major Briggs world building development or something like that. Whatever this turns out to be, I think I'm for it, and I want it to hit me really hard.
Honestly, I just don't want it to end because I don't know what there is to look forward to after this.
Mark Frost, Twin Peaks, The Final Dossier.
And I guess the soundtrack, you know, by that bad boy on vinyl.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Get Windswept playing along. Yeah.
And
But no, I do agree. There. I mean, you know, that says as much about my life as anything else, but there will definitely be a void once this is done. Hopefully, though, the final result will leave a certain a warm contentment in the belly, like a nice full pot roast dinner.
Maybe. You have all the Halloween costumes to look forward to.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, no, lime green jackets are going to be very popular this October.
maybe it'll inspire us all to make great art.
I mean, this podcast is great art.
Yeah, true. Pat podcasts are the new novel. But overall, I think this was a strong hour of television. And Zach, where again can we find you on the internet?
Oh, where have I written for? Little White Lies and Movie Notebook, usually. I'm on twitter.com/zewillew, ZEEWILLEW. I put my musings there. I teach, but I'm going to come back to writing pretty soon. Don't you worry.
Hell yeah. Any other, are you on Snapchat, Instagram? Where else can we get the adventures of Zach?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I'm looking for some sort of sugar mother at the moment, some sort of sugar daddy figure. If there's anybody out there who just wants to give me a load of money, not expecting anything in return, though, that would be perfect. You can just reach me via some sort of DM thing, and I'll give you my personal details there.
Hell yeah.
I would also suggest if you're in New York on a Friday night, go to China Chalet.
I'll be there. Don't worry. I'm the greeter.
I look forward to not editing this out of the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, though. This is great. This is fun.
Yeah. Thank you again for joining us. Nick, anything you want to plug?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, thefilmsdigital.com. You can also find my desk job doings through Grasshopper Film. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and hopefully we're at a theater near you.
Oh. You can find me at twitter.com/EthanVess, and typically I post things, I contribute, whether it be podcasts or writing, so I won't plug particular sites, though. There is this really good podcast called These Boys Are Good Boys. You might want to check it out. And we should also mention the Film Stage show. The Film Stage, our host, they're launching a Patreon for their podcast. So be sure to contribute to that to get some exclusive content. And thank you again for listening. And I'll see you in the trees.